All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to continue this morning with Kapitel Nun, chapter 15, Tehillim. Our shir is dedicated by the Gross family, Le'ilei Nishmas, Chana Ruvain ben Moshe Aaron, and Sholem Yeshaya ben Yitzchak Mordechai Fishel. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, their neshamas will have an aliyah, and the family a nechama. And of course, we dedicate our learning in the Zuchus of Arafur Shalema for Tami Maskowitz, for Tamara Dina, as kind of Shulamis. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, that she will have a complete and enduring refuah. So let's begin with Kapitel Nun. So what I would like to do today is something just a little bit different than the way we normally go ahead and approach our Tehillim, whereas under normal circumstances, first I kind of give you the overview to the Kapitel, and then we go a little bit into greater depth with some of the other details. I'd like to do a little bit of a... Is that someone's phone? Or is that... Okay. So we're going to go a little bit in a reverse order today, and instead we'll save the general introduction of the Kapitel to next week. Instead today I want to be able to draw your attention to one specific pasuk. But let's actually just look at the opening pasuk. Mizmor the Asaf. Kel Elokim Hashem Diber Vaikra Aretz Mimizrach Shemesh Ad Mevo'o. A psalm by Asaf, bless you Almighty God. The Lord spoke and called to the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. So there are a number of interesting things about this Kapitel already. First of all, we're being introduced to Asaf. Now, who Asaf is and what exactly Asaf's role is in Tehillim, we'll discuss more next week. But just understand the general theme of this particular chapter, and you could scan it on your own, but the general theme is the intense desire of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to reveal himself to us. That, you know, we have this concept, you know, for example, Chazal discussed the idea that as much as a baby needs to nurse, a baby needs to eat, so the mother needs to express the milk as well. Chazal used that metaphor for HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. We want to receive divine blessing from God, but God has an incredible amount of blessing to give out as well. So as much as we want to receive, the Ribono Shel Olam wants to give even more. There's that incredible relationship. And you see this concept in many different areas where the Ribono Shel Olam yearns for a particular type of intimate closeness with us. And very often when that intimate closeness does not occur, it's not because of God holding back, but it's often because we hold back. Because we're unwilling to fully vest ourselves or invest ourselves in that relationship. So that's the theme of this Kapitel over here as well. Because Baruch was saying, I want to be close to you. I want you to know me. I want you to understand me. I want to have a beautiful, meaningful, and passionate relationship. So what often holds or prevents that relationship from occurring? So again, we'll begin to touch on this, but part of the theme of the Kapitel, you know, this is a very important idea. The Ribono Shel Olam does not demand perfection. That's why very often we misinterpret the mitzvah or the statement, Tamim Tiyam Hashem Alkecha. Pat Torah says, Tamim Tiyam Hashem Alkecha. So we often translate Tamim as how? Perfect. As perfect. So Tamim does not mean perfect, because the Ribono Shel Olam can never demand, command, or expect perfection, because it's simply beyond our ability to deliver on perfection. So if Tamim doesn't mean perfect, what does Tamim mean? It means complete. So you're saying to yourself, well, completion doesn't sound that much less than perfection. The idea ultimately is completion. The way Chazal often understand it is that the Ribono Shel Olam asks us to be genuine. He asks us to be genuine. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to get everything right. But just try to be a genuine individual. So what does it mean to be genuine? To be genuine means not to misrepresent myself as something that I am not. I have to recognize I have faults, I have shortcomings. I have to own those faults and shortcomings, do whatever I can to rectify and address those faults and shortcomings, and not pretend like they don't exist. The one thing that the Ribono Shel Olam can't handle is when we are disingenuous with him, but more importantly, when we're disingenuous with ourselves. Because if I am not genuine, if I am not honest with myself, then growth becomes impossible. If I have this kind of contorted view of who and what I am, or if I go ahead and I justify all of my mistakes or all of my shortcomings, it is impossible to grow, it's impossible to advance. So all the Ribono Shel Olam asks of us is, be honest with him, and be honest with ourselves. And that's why the things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu and David HaMelech discusses this idea is when we are disingenuous. So for example, we'll see, and we'll get into this more next week. So for example, David HaMelech makes reference to the idea that sometimes we give karbanos. Now of course, again, remember David HaMelech didn't build the Beis HaMikdash, but he was foreshadowing what was going to occur. We bring karbanos, we engage in external acts of piety, even though inside sometimes we're broken and shattered. And the Ribbono Shel Olam sometimes tells us, save your karbanos. It's okay, I don't need your karbanos. I don't need your libations. Work on yourself. Work on becoming a genuine person, and then I'll be happy to accept anything and everything. But if you think that you're discharging your religious or spiritual obligation by showing up to the Beis HaMikdash, giving an animal, and suddenly now you're done, all is good, you're fooling yourself. You're not fooling me, God says. The only person you're deluding at the end of the day is yourself. And a person who lives kind of in this construct or framework of self-delusion. And unfortunately, we all delude ourselves to a certain degree. Sometimes the only way to make it through the day is to delude ourselves a little bit or to distract ourselves a little bit and not to be constantly focused on our faults, our negativities. So to a certain degree, maybe we have to do it. But at some point in time, this is what Chazal, this is what the Sifrei Moser speak about, Cheshbon HaNefesh. Cheshbon HaNefesh is this introspective moment where I just take the time to understand who I am and what I am, and understand what I am and what I'm not. I do many things well, and there are many things in which I'm really not doing well, and many areas in which I'm really underperforming, and many areas in which I really have to, you know, push it up a level. But that only comes when a person is genuine and honest with themselves. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, David HaMelech, takes us to task for not being genuine. Never taking us to task for not being perfect, because that is not the expectation, but for being disingenuous. And one of the things that David HaMelech says, and I want to draw your attention to this, if you take a look at Pasuk Chaf in number 1, chapter verse 20. So the Pasuk says, Teshev ba'achicha tedaber b'men imcha, titein dofi. Teshev, when you sit, you sit down to talk against your brother, your mother's son you defame. So if you look at number 2, the Radak says, Teshev. What does it mean you sit down? Teshev b'moshav leitzim. Sometimes in life you keep the wrong company. You know, so much of an individual's success in life is all dependent on chevra, all dependent on my friends, all dependent on my social circles. You know, very often in life, one of the greatest forms of self-delusion is that we like to think that we could expose ourselves to all different types of circumstances and influences and still stay strong. It won't impact me. And of course, we know that's unequivocally false. Every single thing we do in life, every relationship we have, every exposure we have, absolutely leaves its residual mark on our soul. So I could want to have, I might have friends who could be the most wonderful people, but you know, sometimes people who are quote-unquote good people may not be the right influences for me. And lest I think that it's okay, I could distance myself, it's not going to impact me, it's false, it's not true. So David HaMelech says, Teshev, very often, who do we sit among? B'moshav leitzim. We sit with the wrong people. We sit with the wrong people. This is always a little bit of a tension, because on one hand, we condition ourselves and we work on ourselves to love everyone. And that's true. You have to love every single Jew, whether they're good or they're not so good, for one simple reason, because every Jew is good. Just some people realize they're good. Some people don't yet realize they're good. Some people have accessed their good. Some people have not yet accessed their good. But every single Jew is good. See, here's the interesting reality in life. Just because you're supposed to love everyone doesn't mean you're supposed to sit with everyone. The idea ultimately is, I have to love every single Jew, and there are no exceptions to that rule. You know, often people say, of course I love every Jew, except, right? Except that group, or except that one, or except people who do this. There are no exceptions to the statement of V'yavdre HaKamocha. You have to love every single Jew. That being said, I also have an obligation to make sure that I surround myself with the type of experiences, exposures, and relationships that are conducive to my growth. So I love everyone. It doesn't mean I'm friends with everyone. I love everyone. It doesn't mean I'm sitting down with everyone. I love everyone. It doesn't mean that everyone is here. Some certain people are kept over here. And that is by design. And I just want to be clear. Keeping certain people at a distance is not a lack of love for those individuals. You could love, your heart could be brimming with Ahavas Yisrael, which halavai we should all be zocha, but I also recognize there are certain people that might not be good for me, or certain influences that might be toxic for me. So I'm going to keep you close in my heart, but I'm going to keep you a little bit at arm's length in life. A very difficult balance. So David HaMelech says, so part of the disingenuousness that sometimes we have to contend with is this teshuv. We sit with the wrong people, but it gets worse. And sometimes we speak negatively, even about our own family members, about our own brothers, my paternal brother. Now says David HaMelech, you know what? I could see why there might be a motivation to speak ill of my paternal brother. Why? Because there's an inherent competition with a paternal brother. What's the inherent competition? Yerusha, right? The one major thing that tears so many families apart. Yerusha, inheritance. Remember, again, from a halachic perspective, only paternal brothers inherit a father's estate. Maternal brothers do not inherit. So David HaMelech says, number one, so sometimes teshuv, we associate with the wrong people and we think that I can have all of these types of influences and it won't impact me. I'm fooling myself. This is an incredible, I mean, again, this is not our share, but I can't tell you how important this is also in the realm of parenting. In the realm of parenting, it's amazing to me sometimes what parents give their children access to. Somehow thinking that if you let your kid have access to A, B, C, and D, but you put them in a Jewish school, that's something like the Jewish school is like the spiritual booster shot against any type of spirit. It's craziness. It's craziness. There is nothing wrong with being a little bit of a dictator when it comes to parenting. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with absolutely being on your kids like a hawk in terms of what they're exposed to, what they're reading, what they're watching, what kind of entertainment they're engaging in. Remember again, this used to be, I mean, a long time ago when I was a child in the shtetl, you know, it could be, you know, you could watch perhaps sporting events, and it was generally usher. And I apologize for even using these terms, the mild pornography that you even find on public access television. It's wild. It's wild. To be honest, there's nothing that's safe. I hate to sound like, there's nothing that's, I'm not like going to rage against the internet next, I promise. But there's nothing that's safe. So again, does it mean that you become a hermit and live in a cave? No. But what it absolutely requires from a parenting perspective is that you have to hover. You absolutely have to hover. And if you allow your children access to certain things, you better make sure that you know every single second of content that they are watching or they are absorbing, because if you blink for a second, there is no telling what they could be exposed to. And here's the sad part. Once those exposures occur, you can't dial them back. You can't dial them back. Once you see something, you can't unsee it. Once you hear something, you can't unhear it. Once those exposures are done, nebuch, there is a certain amount of innocence that is lost that can never be regained. It's not just true with parenting, it's true even in a marriage. How a couple has to be so careful that whatever their exposures are as a couple, whether it's in social settings or in recreational settings, everything has to be bikidusha betara. Because if you think that you could do something in a recreational way, and at the end of the day it's not going to impact the quality of a shalom bayis, unequivocally false. Everything we do, everything we watch, everything we engage in, everything we participate in has a dramatic effect on who and what we are. So David HaMelech says, Jews, you're being a little bit disingenuous because you're doing whatever you want and you think that you're still remaining strong because your actions don't have an impact on you. It's not true. Teshuv, where you decide to sit in life, has a dramatic impact on the people we become. But not only that, says David HaMelech. You know what? You have discord, you have disagreements with other people, fine. But we expect people to be able to get together with their family. David HaMelech, again, is railing against the disingenuosity. I know that's not a word, but I'm going to use it for today. The disingenuousness of calling, so you can't even get along with your family? Okay, so maybe you're going to say you don't get along with your paternal brother because you're fighting over Yerusha. But you're not just speaking ill of your paternal brother. What else does it say? Ubebeni mecha. With a brother, your maternal brother. What competition do you have with your maternal brother? There's no money involved in that relationship, right? There's no Yerusha involved in that relationship. And you still can't get along with those individuals. Says David HaMelech, sometimes the lack of genuineness, probably not the right English word either, but the lack of being a genuine individual often manifests itself in a person's inability to get along with immediate family. You know, now again, sometimes there are situations where a person, you know, relationships are an interesting thing, because at the end of the day, I could try my hardest. If there's not, as they say, a partner in peace, you know, if there's not another family member who's interested in a relationship, I can't get anywhere. But sometimes in life, we have to recognize that animosity builds up, and often that's a two-way street. and how careful we have to be with all of our life relationships, but often understand if you can't go ahead and have a normal relationship with your brother, with your sister, with your immediate family, it's going to be difficult to go ahead and build relationships outside of the family. I think we discussed, did we discuss Freud last week? Maybe a different share. You know, people think that it was, right, Freud was famous for highlighting many things, but for one of the ideas is that he felt that often when people encounter different psychological issues, it's often a manifestation of a state of disrepair in their relationship with their parents, right? That people have unresolved parenting, or not parenting issues, but issues with their parents that manifest itself in other places in life. Now, the truth is, we knew that way before Freud, right? The truth is, all you need to do is look in Bereshis, and you can see what happens when people don't have good and harmonious relationship with their parents, how that manifests itself in other areas of life. But to take it a step further, David HaMelech is saying this, if I can't get along with those people who are closest to me, then how am I going to be able to forge relationships elsewhere? So you could be disingenuous, and you could say, it's their fault. You know, it's their fault. So just, here's a cloud gadol. There are some people who go through life, and they always have someone else to blame. See, here's an important idea. If everything that goes wrong in your life is someone else's fault, chances are it's your fault. Again, if there are one or two areas that you put the blame on someone else, but for 99% of what goes on in your life, you take responsibility, it is possible that it's someone else's fault. But if it's always someone else's fault, if someone always did something else wrong, if someone never lived up to the expectations, never did what they are supposed to do, it's time to start pointing there and time to start pointing here. Person has to observe, and David HaMelech goes out, David HaMelech says, you have to be genuine. If there is a state of disrepair in a family, it's easy to write it off as someone else's fault, but I have to ask myself, what is my role in this? Now again, could it be that it's not totally my fault? Absolutely. But generally, in the realm of familial conflict, there's generally multiple players who contribute in multiple different ways. So David HaMelech over here, again, speaking about the idea, saying Klal Yisrael, the Ribbono Shel Olam yearns to have a relationship with us, yearns to be close with us, yearns to reveal His greatness, yearns to shower down His blessing, and all He requires of us is to be genuine. And one of the ways in which we reflect this genuinity in life is to be able to have shalom within our families, to be able to have shalom within our immediate circles. Because if I can't create shalom in those immediate circles, it's going to be difficult to cultivate other relationships in life, including our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I'm going to be honest with you. As I was preparing the shiur, it struck me that that's really these past parshios. So it's really amazing that if you look at the dominant theme of the parshios of the last really 3 weeks, Toldos, Vayetze, and now Vayishlach. So what do we have unfolding over here? We have the animosity between brothers. We have the animosity of Yaakov and Esav. Now, who caused that animosity? So again, remember, that's a difficult question to answer. Because on one hand, again, Esav is very upset that Yaakov went ahead and stole the brachas. But Yaakov, remember, it's important to say, Yaakov didn't technically steal the brachas. Yaakov was entitled to the Bechora. But yet Yaakov, upon the advice of his mother, employed seemingly deceitful means to be able to get the bracha. And we'll get into that a little bit more. But there is an incredible breakdown. And understand, again, the fallout from Toldos. And this is the most important thing. You know, we end Parshas Toldos. Yaakov gets the bracha. And remember, again, Rivka and Yitzchak both send away Yaakov, but for two different reasons. Rivka tells Yaakov to leave the house. Why? Because your brother is going to kill you. Yitzchak tells Yaakov to leave the house. Why? To go find a wife. Now, that's, by the way, just another discussion. Shlomo Shmuel Hirsch has an incredible piece when he speaks about the marital dynamic of Yitzchak and Rivka. Were they on the same page? Did they communicate? Not our topic, but they send Yaakov away for two different reasons. But I want to point something out. At the end of Parshas Toldos, what is the home life of Yitzchak and Rivka like? It's a disaster. It's a disaster. Esav left home. Now, granted, he was already older, but again, he left home, and understandably so. He felt betrayed by his parents. Right? Remember, again, the secret's out. Meaning, the story must come out that Esav finds out that it was his own mother that gave his younger brother, his own clothing to disguise. His own mother betrayed him. Yitzchak is seemingly ignorant, but who knows? Maybe he's in on it also. You have to understand the pain. You know, I want to just point out, when we think of Esav, so we often think like he was born an axe murderer, right? We have this idea that he was born, so he's Admoni, he's ruddy, he's ready to kill, he's coming out. Understand, I'm sure Esav was a delightful little baby. Little babies are wonderful, and little babies are beautiful. And I'm sure Esav gave his parents incredible nachas when he took his first steps and when he said his first words, and he was a good boy. You see, the problem we often have when we learn Chumash, we learn Tanakh, we know the end of the story. So often what we do is we take the end and we project it back on the beginning. So already from the beginning, Esav's evil. Who says? Who says? Rashi sees hints to the negativity of his personality that are already present in his youth. But understand, Esav is also a child. And what children want more than anything is the love and approval and acceptance of their parents. If you are Esav, the biological firstborn, and you just realize that, your own parents sold you out. Your own parents conspired against you to go ahead. No one even said, hey, Esav, heard you sold the Bechorah. You know what that means? No. Now, what people know, what they didn't know in the story is the whole machlokes as well. But understand, I'm just pointing out the feeling. I'm not trying to make Esav like the victim over here, that we should start like an Esav fund. That's not what I'm saying. But understand, it is an often overlooked dynamic of the story. The hurt and the pain of Esav for the feelings of betrayal, his whole family turned against him. His brother, his mother, his father, it's not exactly clear, but he clearly ended up giving the brachos to Yaakov. Esav leaves the house. Yaakov leaves the house, and Yitzchak and Rivka are all alone. Are all alone. Remember again, when Rivka says goodbye to Yaakov, she never sees Yaakov again. Rivka Aminu dies before Yaakov comes back from the house of Lavan. She said goodbye to her son at the end of Parshas Toldos, and that was the end. Parshas Toldos ends with a profoundly broken family of Yitzchak and Rivka. The family is in a state of disrepair. And over the course of the Parshios, of Toldos, of Vayetze. Yetze, we don't really hear that much about Esav, but then remember, it all comes to a head this week's parasha, Parashas Vayishlach. So what happens in Parashas Vayishlach? Remember again, there is this much dreaded encounter between Yaakov and Esav. The last time the brothers saw each other was when they just missed each other by a few moments, right? Yaakov was leaving Yitzchak after having received the blessings, and Esav was going in. That was the last time the brothers brushed shoulders with each other, so to speak. And now, over 20 years later, they are meeting up for the first time. And the context of it is a profoundly broken family. So when I saw this pasuk from David HaMelech, I decided that I want to just go on a little bit of a detour and use this just as a springboard to go on and speak a little bit about the parasha. Also, I'm not giving my parasha shir tonight, so I figured this is a wonderful opportunity to chaperein over here. So let's take a look at number three. So I want to explore. So again, David HaMelech introduces us to this idea that the most heightened level of disingenuousness is an inability to hold a family together. So I want to just point something out to you. Take a look at number three. So remember again, Yaakov Avinu is getting ready, just to give you the context. He has his wives, he has his sons, right? And remember at this point, everyone except Binyamin is born. So at this point in time, they're coming back to Eretz Canaan. He's coming back and leaving Laban's home into Eretz Canaan. And what happens? He's told that Esav is coming with 400 men. So the Torah says, number three, Vayakam balaylahu, vayikach eshtei nosha, veshtei shifchosav, ve'es achad asar yiladav, vayavor es ma'avar yabok. So what happens? In the middle of the night, Yaakov Avinu is moving the family. He takes his wives, the two wives, the two maidservants, the 11 children, and crosses them over ma'avar yabok. So just by the way, something amazing, if you ever drive down the Jordan Valley Road. If you drive up north, and instead of taking Route 6, you drive down the Jordan Valley Road, so you'll notice there's a little sign that says, Ma'avar Yabok. We know where Yaakov Avinu crossed over. We know where Klal Yisrael crossed over the Yarden. We know where Yaakov Avinu crossed over. Incredible. Little, again, the Jordan was much bigger in those times. But again, Yaakov Avinu crosses over Ma'avar Yabok. Vayikachim vayayirem esanachal vayaver eskalashalo. Vayivoser Yaakov levado, vayiovik ish imo adalos hashachar. And of course, again, the dramatic episode occurs where Yaakov Avinu is all alone, and what happens? This mysterious ish, this mysterious man, fights with Yaakov Avinu until dawn. Pasuk Chavav, verse 26, number 3. Vayar kilo yachalo, vayga bekaf yerecho, vateka kaf yerech Yaakov yavkoimo. So what happens? He goes ahead the angel, or I should say the Ish, goes ahead and takes hold of Yaakov Avinu's thigh. Now the little translation over here is he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Yaakov's hip became dislocated as he wrestled with it. Now we see that's not really a precise translation. It's not really his hip that he was hurting. We'll discuss in just a moment. So what happens? Vayomer shachini ki Allah shachar emol ha'shalechacha kein berachtani. And the Ish says, let me go, it's dawn. And Yaakov says, I'm not going to go ahead and let you go until you bless me. Skip down a little bit. Pasuk Lamed Beis, verse 32. Vayizrach lo ha-shemesh kasher avar es penuel v'utzolea al yirecho. So the morning after the night-long struggle, Yaakov Avinu is still standing, but he is limping. Therefore, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, verse 33. Akein lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael es gid ha-noshe. Therefore, Klal Yisrael may not eat the Git Hanasha, which we translate as the sciatic nerve. The sciatic nerve, Asha Kaf HaYerach, Adayomazeh, until this very day, Kinaga Bekaf Yerach Yaakov Begit Hanasha. So apparently Yaakov Avinu, when he was injured in this fight with this unknown Ish, with this unknown man, this Ish injures him in the sciatic nerve. So understand, the sciatic nerve is the longest, widest single nerve in the human and animal body. So Yaakov Avinu somehow was injured in this sciatic nerve, and as a result, we don't eat the Gid Hanosha. We don't eat the sciatic nerve as part of an animal. So I'd like to try to explore this a little bit. What does this mean? Such a strange idea. Yaakov Avinu was injured in the sciatic nerve, so we don't eat the sciatic nerve. What exactly is happening over here? What's the meaning of this remembrance, and what's the lesson for us? So if you take a look, if we take a look at the Radak writes over here, number 4, Alkin lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael, b'nei Yaakov asrua al atzma l'kavod avihem. So remember again, what the Radak is pointing out over here, something very interesting. God never commands the children of Yaakov not to eat the sciatic nerve, right? If you notice again, like, there's never a tzivoy, there's never a command that says, because Yaakov was injured in the sciatic nerve, therefore the Jewish people may not eat the sciatic. There was never a divine command. The Radak says, the Jewish people accepted this practice upon themselves. V'hem tzivu libneihem, they commanded their children afterwards. V'ne'esar lahem ulibnei b'neihem ad olam. So this is very important. The Radak is getting into another interesting idea, which is based on the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi says, Ein lemeid n'davar mikol dematan Torah. Nothing that is recorded in the Torah is halachically binding if it occurred before Sinaitic revelation. In other words, let me give you an example of that. Why do we do Bris Milah? Right? Why do we do Bris Milah? So the simple answer always is Avraham Avinu. So that's not true. That's not true. Why? Because any event that occurred before Matan Torah, before Sinaitic revelation, cannot create a halachically binding precedent. Therefore, that's why, if you'll notice, the Torah goes out of its way again in Parshas Tazria to once again teach us the mitzvah of Bris Milah. Bris Milah only, now again, Avraham Avinu taught us about the concept of Bris Milah, but Bris Milah only becomes a binding halachic obligation because the Torah restates it again after Sinaitic revelation. So Radak's pointing out over here that what happened? Originally there was no command to not eat the sciatic nerve. The children of Yaakov decided to do this as a form of honor to their father. And therefore, again, they did it. They passed it down to their children. And up until the point that the Jewish people were standing at Mount Sinai, the Jews were not eating Gid Hanasha. The Ribbono Shel Olam saw this practice, and therefore, says the Radak, built it into Torah. Now, of course, in the grand scheme of things, it was part of Torah from the beginning. That's the Chachmas Habore. But the evolution of this halacha is, it started as a show of honor to their father and became part of religious, formalized religious practice at Sinaitic revelation. Okay, take a look. Take a look at number 6. Rashbam writes, why didn't they eat the Gid Hanasha? L'zichron gvurasa shal Yaakov. As they didn't eat the Gid Hanasha as a sign, as a remembrance of the strength of Yaakov. That Yaakov Avinu was able to remain standing throughout the night, did not succumb to the Ish. They didn't eat the Gid Hanasha as a sign of a respect for Yaakov, the miracle of Yaakov. Chizkuni writes in number 7. He says something amazing over here. He says, Alkin lo yochol, kmo huvolo kin yidne, kin lomar, bedinu sheish liknos velenosh b'nei Yisrael achilas. Now, the Chizkuni says something amazing. In general, When we want to remember something, we generally do something in a positive fashion, right? If we want to, so for example, right, we have a Yom Tov of Hanukkah coming along, so we mark the miracles in an active way. We light the menorah. In general, when we want to mark miraculous events, we don't mark them by abstaining from something, we mark them by engaging in something. So the Chizkuni is bothered by, why are we marking this incredible miraculous event that Yaakov Avinu survived the night with the Ish by abstaining from something? And the Chizkuni says, because the abstention from eating the Gid Hanasha is a Musar for Klal Yisrael. What's the Musar? What's the lesson? What's the rebuke? If you remember, again, the way the Torah introduces the story, this narrative of Yaakov Avinu's struggle with the Ish in number 3, the Torah says, Vayvaser Yaakov Levado. Yaakov was alone. And asks the Chizkuni, how could it be that Yaakov was left alone? You have 11 children. You have multiple spouses. How could it be that no one was with you? How could it be they left you alone even for a moment? So says the Chizkuni. Therefore what? Almost like as a little bit of an onesh, as a little bit of a punishment, as a patch to Klal Yisrael, as a musra to Klal Yisrael, we don't eat the Gid Hanasha. In other words, what did we do? We gave up something. Now, I don't know how tasty the sciatic nerve is. I have typhus from many things. Sciatic nerve is not one of them. But again, whatever it is, we gave it up. We gave it up. So we gave something up as a form of atonement for having wronged our patriarch. And by the way, the lesson for all future generations is, always circle the wagons. No Jew left behind. There should never be such a thing as a Jew who is alone. There should never be such a thing as someone who is without the help of the community, who is without the help of the extended family. And therefore is a constant reminder that we can never again allow for a dynamic of Vayivaser Yaakov Levado, of someone being left alone. We don't eat the Gid Hanasha. It is the remembrance to leave no Jew behind. Look at number 8. The Sefer HaChinuch takes a different approach. The Sefer HaChinuch says that this is an incredible foreshadow for the future. It says, Mishrashei mitzvah zu, kidei shetiyah remez liYisrael, sha'af api sheyispalu tzaros rabos begolios miyad ha'amim, umiyad b'nei Esav, sheyiyu betuchim shlo yavdu, al yolam yamdu zerem b'shmam, v'yavol ha'am gos. So says the Sefer HaChinuch, let me tell you this outside. He says, the struggle with Yaakov and the Ish, remember again, where does the struggle take place? The struggle takes place right outside of the land of Israel. Right outside, right on the other side of the Jordan. Right outside of the territorial borders, at least, biblical Eretz Israel. So what happens, says the Sefer HaChinuch, that struggle with the Ish represents the struggle of Galus, represents the struggle of diaspora, right? Last 2 years, we've had 2,000 years of struggles. And that struggle goes on through a long, dark night. And here's the amazing part. What's the foreshadow? What's the metaphor? No matter how intense the struggle, when the sun comes up, we will always be standing. Klal Yisrael will never succumb. Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. Klal Yisrael will always endure. But it doesn't mean we don't get injured. It doesn't mean that when we walk away, when the sun comes up and we're still on our feet, we might be on our feet, but we're what? But we're limping. Because over the years, we endure injuries. Over the years, ultimately, again, we have our difficulties. It is true, we remain valiantly fighting throughout the night, and when the sun comes up, we are still standing, but not without injury, not without heartbreak, and not without loss. Klal Yisrael will never fall to the ground. Klal Yisrael will always remain standing. But it doesn't mean that there's not a lot of pain throughout that dark night of Galus. So these are all, and again, I'm just giving you different interpretations as to the mitzvah. But I want to draw your attention to one additional piece, because perhaps there's one other important level of understanding about the Gid Hanasha, and that helps us understand its relevance to us today, and more importantly, its particular relevance to Yaakov in the matzav, in the situation he was in. So in order to understand really the true, I think, meaning, depth, and profundity of the prohibition of eating the Gid Hanasha, we have to take a step back and analyze for a moment the Ish, the man. So the Torah just tells us that Yaakov Avinu goes ahead and struggles with the Ish. He struggles with this man the entire night. And of course, we don't know who the Ish is. I'll just point out, by the way, there's a number of times, of pivotal moments, where a guy shows up. So we have it over here by Yaakov Avinu. We'll see it again in next week's parasha, by the way, when Yosef goes out to find his brothers. So the Torah says, "Vayimtze ehu ish v'inetor basada." There's a guy. There's a guy, some unnamed ish, Rav Soloveitchik calls this the man of destiny. The man of destiny, that there are certain moments when people reach a fork in the road and somehow the man of destiny often appears to help try to guide us in the right direction. In any event, Yaakov Avinu struggles with this mysterious ish. Who is the ish? So the Medrash, actually quoted by Rashi, number 10, says the following, Rabbi Chama, Rabbi Chanina, Amar, Saro Shal Esav Haya. It was none other than the ministering angel of Esav. Each and every nation of the world has its own dedicated angel. There is only one nation who doesn't have a dedicated ministering angel, and that's who? Klal Yisrael. We don't have a dedicated angel because, again, Chelek Hashem Avo Nachala. So we, Ribon Shalom is ours. Meaning we, well, he's not ours, he belongs to everyone, but we are his. He does not give us a ministering angel, he watches over us himself. So says the Medrash, Yaakov Avinu is fighting the whole night with the ministering angel of Esav. Now why? What's the nature of this fight? And I want to tell you something absolutely amazing. If you take a look at number 11, the Chizkuni writes, "Vayavek ish imo malach bidemus ish." It was an angel who appeared like a man. Why? Shelo yuchal livroach. In order that Yaakov cannot run away. And he should be able to see the fulfillment of the promise of God, that Esav will not hurt him. Ad alos ha-shachar. So says the Chizkuni something absolutely amazing. You see, everyone thinks, that when it says the Yaakov, he's crossing Ma'avar Yabok, he's coming from Chutz Laaretz into Eretz Yisrael. The Chizkuni says something jaw-droppingly amazing. He says, in the middle of the night, Yaakov Avinu has a change of heart. The whole day he's preparing. Remember again, he's preparing in three different ways, Chazal tell us. What are the three ways? He's preparing ultimately with tefillah, with prayer, with doron, with gift, and with milchama for war. He says we're going to split the camps. And then says the Chizkuni something absolutely amazing. In the middle of the night, Yaakov Avinu has a change of heart. I'm running away. I can't do this. Bless you. I can't do this. I cannot face my brother in the morning. I can't do it. I can't do it to my family. And so in the middle of the night, he begins the process to run away. Not himself, of course, but the whole family. So it says the Chizkuni, when the Torah tells us that he crosses over Ma'avar Yabok, he's not coming into Eretz Yisrael. In fact, he's doing a 180 and trying to run away from Esav. Therefore, says the Chizkuni, the Ribono Shel Olam dispatches the Ish, dispatches the man, dispatches the ministering angel of Esav to keep Yaakov Avinu occupied until the morning. Because if he's occupied until the morning, then what? He can't run. He's out of time. He can't run away. And in fact, take a look at number 13. The Sfarno writes, Vayavik Ishimo Hayaze Poa Malach B'mitzvas Bor'o. You see, we often think that the angel of Esav started up with Yaakov Avinu on his own. It's important to understand, no one could start up with a Jew on their own. Only person who can start up with a Jew is someone who is commanded by God to do so. So the Malach of Esav can't start up with Yaakov Avinu. So rather, the Ribono Shel Olam dispatched the angel of Esav, who can imagine was only too happy to do battle with Yaakov Avinu, to keep Yaakov Avinu locked in battle the entire night. And by the time the battle was over, the sun was up, it was already too late to run, too late to escape. The entire point of the struggle was to prevent Yaakov Avinu from running away from Esav. Take a look at number 14. Rav Soloveitchik says something amazing over here. The Rav writes, the Rav explained, then in the end, by the way, the Rav makes an amazing observation. Remember again, I said before, at the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, Yaakov Avinu says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to split the camps. Why should we split the camps? Why? Because Yaakov Avinu is contemplating the possibility of casualties. So like this, if we split the camp, the one group that Esav engages will give the other group the opportunity to flee. Yet, interestingly enough, does the division of the camp ever actually occur? No, says that. It never occurs. I mean, look in the Pesukim, we even see it. The Torah says, Torah discusses that Yaakov Avinu brings his family one after the other to meet Esav. There was no division of the camps. What happened? So look what the Rav writes. The Rav explained that in the end, Yaakov never divides the camp because the Malach delayed him. So he didn't have time. This is why Vayisa Einav Vihine Esav. Right after he finishes struggling with the Malach, what happened? The Torah says, he lifted his eyes, and boom, Esav was there. He lifted his eyes, and Esav was upon him. The reason Hashem sent the Malach was because it wasn't proper what Yaakov planned to do. Al-Pidin, according to the letter of the law, it is not right to sacrifice one machaneh so the other may live. So to take the Rav's words a step further, What's happening over here? The Ribono Shel Olam is keeping Yaakov Avinu occupied so that he can't split the camps and that he can't run. Splitting the camps would have been what? Would have been a partial admission of defeat. Running away from Esav would have been a partial admission of defeat. The Ribono Shel Olam is telling Yaakov Avinu once and all, Yaakov, it's time to stop running. If we go back, what we know about Yaakov Avinu, the Torah says, number 15, Vayignov Yaakov eslev Lavan ha'arami, ad b'li higidlo ki boreachu. Yaakov Avinu goes ahead. Remember again, earlier in the parasha, the Torah used a very interesting wording. Vayignov Yaakov eslev Lavan. I probably didn't put the English translation. What does that mean? Vayignov Yaakov eslev Lavan? Stole his heart. What does that mean? He deceived him. The Torah is using a very unflattering expression to describe Yaakov Avinu's actions. The Torah says that Yaakov Avinu deceived Lavan. Let me ask you this question. Why does Yaakov Avinu sneak away from the house of Lavan in the middle of the night? Why does he deceive his father and pretend like he's going out to shepherd the flock, but in fact he gets the family together? Why did he do that? To avoid confrontation. Yaakov Avinu is conflict averse. Yaakov Avinu does not like conflict. And in fact, if you take a look at number 16, the Torah says, Vayigdulu ha'na'arim, look how the Torah describes them, Vayi'esav ish yodeh tzayid, ish yodeh tzayid, ish soda, v'yaakov ish tam yoshev o'alim. So remember again, what does it mean, ish tam yoshev o'alim? You know, first of all, our association with tam is often not a positive one, right? We automatically think about what? Right, the Abrabanim, right? You think about the Tam, who's just a notch above the Ishadeh Lishal. So what does it mean that he's Tam Yoshev? On a simple level, what it means is, Yaakov Avinu was a pleasant person. Yaakov Avinu was a nice guy. Yaakov Avinu was uninterested in conflict. Yaakov Avinu was uninterested in fighting. Yaakov Avinu was uninterested in butting heads with anyone. And that's why, again, remember, when Rivka Imenu summons Yaakov, she says, Yaakov, here's the deal. You have to go dress up as your brother, right? And you have to go ahead and take the brachas. What's Yaakov Avinu's reaction? His reaction really is, he doesn't say explicitly no to his mother because he wants to have derech eretz and covered for her, but essentially he says, Vayiti be'enav kemitateya. I can't do this. My father's going to hate me for it. My brother is going to hate me for it. And I am conflict averse. I'm not interested in machlokes with anyone. So what's happening over here? Yaakov Avinu spends his life in a conflict averse state. So therefore, again, if we fast forward over here in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, Yaakov Avinu spends a whole day readying his family for the encounter with Esav. And then in the middle of the night, you can imagine, he wakes up in a cold sweat and he says to himself, What am I doing? I don't need this. I'm just going to run. I'm just going to run. Let me get away from Esav. Look, we've avoided each other for 22 years. We'll avoid each other for the next 22 years. I'll keep figuring out how to avoid him. And let me get out of here. I have no interest in dealing with this conflict head on. My only interest is to get away from here as quickly as possible. So the Ribono Shel Olam comes along and says, Yaakov, you can't run. You can't run. I'm going to keep you occupied the whole night. See, it's interesting. It might have not been enough even if God would have said to Yaakov, stay put. He needs to keep Yaakov actively engaged the entire night. Miraculously, the fight ends right as the sun comes up. Right in the moment where Esav is right upon him, that's when the fight ends. Look at the Mishnah number 17. Ben Zoma says, Ezehu Gibor, who is strong? Hakovesh es Yitzro. Now literally we translate this as, who is strong? One who is able to rein in. Yitzro we normally translate as his desires. So if you look at the Rabbeinu Yonah, writes, if you just skip down a little bit towards the end, he says in the second to last line, in the middle of the line after the period, V'gam koach kavishas hayetzer. So Ben Zoma seems to say the following, we all have wants, we all have desires, we all have pushes and pulls that want to propel us in different directions. And true gvura, true strength, means mastery over temptation. True strength is mastery over my desires. All of us are pulled in different directions. True gvura, true strength, is the willingness to say, I want this, and I want it badly, but I'm going to exercise the art of restraint. You know, sometimes the greatest accomplishments are not in what we do, but in what we don't do. Sometimes the ability to withstand temptation, sometimes the ability to go ahead and hold myself back, sometimes the ability to restrain myself. Again, we all have different Yetzaharas, and this manifests itself differently for each of us, but that's what Ben Zoma seems to say. And if you take a look at Tosas Yom Tov, number 19, he says the same idea. Hakovesh es Yitzro, Yetzahara, Nikra Yetzer Stam. You know, there's this interesting idea, which we're not going to get into today, but Chazal say that a person has a Yitzhara from the time that they are born, but the Yitzhara HaTov doesn't come into the body until the age of Bar Bas Mitzvah. So what exactly that means is a subject to much to see. What it does mean is the Yitzhara has a much stronger hold on me than my Yitzhara HaTov. Right? We don't have to take my word for this. We all experience this. The Yetzer has a much stronger hold on us than the Yetzer HaTov. Therefore, says Ben Zoma, I know it's difficult, but true Gevura is the ability to rein in and to master and to hold on to one's Yetzer. But if you take a look at number 20, the Tosas Yantov says something amazing. Another interpretation is, Shu Yitzro HaMeyuchad Lo V'Nis'at Sein Bo. It could also be that Ben Zoma, when he says, Ezu Gibor, who is strong, Hakovesh es Yitzro, he who reigns in his desires, or his Yetzer, may not just be talking about the Yetzahara. Look at his words. Shehu Yitzro HaMeyuchad Lo. What does this mean? He says, it tells us, Yom Tov. All of us have predispositions. All of us have proclivities. All of us have certain character traits with which we are born. And some of them are very good character traits. But says Ben Zoma, sometimes you have to learn to rein in even your natural dispositions. Sometimes you have to learn to rein in even your good traits. Because sometimes even too much of a good trait is not good. Why am I bringing this down? Because what is Ribbono Shel Olam telling Yaakov of him? He's saying, Yaakov, you know what? The midah of being conflict averse is such a good midah. It's so beautiful, because you know what that means? Yaakov Avinu is a rodef. Remember, if you're conflict averse is like the negative terminology. In a positive way, we would call that being a rodef shalom. Being a rodef shalom. You're someone who is preoccupied with the pursuit of peace. You're someone who tries to whatever degree possible avoid machlokis. Oh, imagine if we could all become rodef shalom. Imagine what our world would look like. Imagine what our people would look like. There are a lot of people who love to fight. They love to fight. And they'll take every opportunity to fight. And they'll take any moment to fight. They'll take any wrong word or wrong gesture to fight. Yaakov Avinu is conflict averse. I don't want to fight. I don't want to fight. By the way, why doesn't Yaakov want to fight? Because he's a coward? Because he's afraid? No. Yaakov Avinu understood a very important lesson. Fighting takes up an incredible amount of emotional energy. Fighting takes up an incredible amount of headspace. Yaakov Avinu says, there's only a certain amount of spiritual emotional koach I have. I could spend it on fighting. I could spend it on machlokes. I don't want to do that. I choose to channel my energies into spiritual growth and development. That's what it means when he says he's an ish tam. Tam means conflict averse. But lest you think that he's conflict averse because he's a coward. No, he's an ishtam. Why? Because Yoshev Olim. Because remember, Yoshev Olim, Rashi says, is all a Torah, spirituality. Yaakov Avinu says, each of us has a certain pool of energy, a certain reservoir of energy. And the choice we have in life is how we use it. Some people use it all up on machlokes. Some people use it all up on fighting. Some people use it up all up on gossiping, all different kinds of things. Because I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in conflict because I'm interested in channeling my energies towards being a Yoshev Olam, towards my spiritual pursuits. A beautiful midah. Except HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Yaakov Avinu that sometimes, Ezehu Gibor, the greatest display of strength is HaKovesh HaSisra. Sometimes even the good qualities that we have, if not kept in check, could ultimately become the greatest disservice and could become the greatest Achilles heel. Ribbono Shel Olam tells Yaakov, you know, Yaakov, you always run. You always run. You run away from conflict. And you know, Yaakov Avinu, remember again, it could very well be that this was also conditioned in him from the episode of the Bechora. His mother told him to be sneaky. He was sneaky. You know, Rashi HaKadosh has the beautiful interpretation when Yaakov Avinu walks into Yitzchak. And Yitzchak says, Yitzchak is already a little suspicious. So he says, who is this? And Yaakov Avinu says, Ani Esav Bechorecha. So Rashi HaKadosh puts like a semicolon there. Ani, it's me, Esav Bechorecha. Esav is your son. Not everybody agrees with Rashi, and even if you agree with Rashi, great. So on a technical level, he didn't lie, but he was deceitful. He was actively deceitful. Granted, he was doing it because his mother told him to do it, meaning he has full coverage on this act. He was following the advice of his mother, and clearly, again, at the end of the day, Yitzchak is mother to the brachos. The Rebbe Shlomo Yaakov was not. But understand, this goes back to what we spoke about before. When you do certain things, it has an impact on you. Yaakov Avinu emerges on the scene in a very sneaky way. What impact that had on him is not immediately clear, but what we do know is he runs away from everything. He runs wherever there's conflict, he runs. He runs away from Lavan, he wants to run away from Esav, and the Rebbe Shalom says to Yaakov, you can't do it. In life, you could be conflict averse, but sometimes you also have to learn to face conflict head on. You can't run from your problems. You can't run from your challenges. You know, people hide behind Shalom all of the time. Right? People often say, oh, I know we have this issue, but I can't deal with it because we'll disrupt the Shalom. Which, if you want the translation of that means, of that is, I'm too scared to deal with it, so I'm going to sound frum and say that it's about Shalom. But it's not really about Shalom. It's because I'm too scared to engage the conflict head on. And this is an incredible balance in life. There are fights that should not be waged. There are disagreements that should not be had. There is machlokas that should not come up. A person should take the high road and try to figure out when to play the card of Shalom. But there are other dynamics that need to be addressed. There are other realities that we must confront head on. There are certain things from which we cannot run for one simple reason. Because as they say, you can't outrun your problems. Even if you run now, it will catch up with you. So you make a choice. It could either overtake you, or you could choose to actively engage it on your own terms. The Ribono Shel Olam sees that Yaakov Avinu is about to go ahead and run once again. You ran away from home, you ran away from Lavan, and now you're going to run away from Esav. And Yaakov, you can't do it. This is a problem in your life. Esav, what are you going to say to your brother who you haven't seen for 22 years? What are you going to say to your brother who, if their tables were reversed, you would be ready to kill him? Because he stole, at least in his eyes, you stole his birthright. You took his destiny. You alienated him from the family. So for Yaakov, he's saying, I don't want to deal with this. And Rebbe Shalom says, you have to deal with it. Because if you don't deal with it, it will follow you for the rest of your life. You can't run from your problems. Instead, sometimes you have to engage it. Yes, is it good to be a Isha Shalom? Is it good to be a man of peace? Absolutely. But Yaakov, don't forget Ben Zoma. Ezehu Gibor, sometimes true strength is a Kovish Es Yisro. You even have to take your good attributes and you have to say, you know what? I need to shelve this for now. Shalom is not the operative thing I need right now. Courage, willingness to engage my problems. I can't run. I have to engage. So what does Ribbono Shel Olam do? Ribbono Shel Olam keeps Yaakov Avinu engaged the entire night in a fight, and not just that. Not just that. Yaakov Avinu is injured in the Gid Hanosha, the sciatic nerve. Why? What does that do? What does that do? He can't run. The Ribbono Shel Olam disables him. The Ribbono Shel Olam knocks him in the Gid Hanosha so that he cannot run from the problems. Even if he chooses to, even if he wants to, he cannot run. And therefore, what does the Torah say? Al kein lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael's Gid Hanosha. So for all future generations, we don't eat the Gid Hanosha either. Why don't we eat the Gid Hanosha? The Gid Hanosha, right, the sciatic nerve. If a person's ever suffered from sciatica, so I know I shouldn't be talking about this, I know, I'm sorry, right? So at the end of the day, it could be disabling. It could be disabling. A person can't walk, a person can't sit, nothing is comfortable. I can't, movement becomes almost impossible under certain extreme circumstances. So what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? He essentially renders Yaakov Avinu immobile. Why? To say, Yaakov, you need to confront this. The mitzvah of Gid Hanosha, for all future generations, what's the message of the mitzvah? The message of the mitzvah is, don't run from your problems. You have to learn to confront. We have to learn to engage. We don't eat the Gid Hanosha because the Gid Hanosha represents mobility. Mobility is a wonderful gift, but sometimes mobility is also an escape. And there are times in life where you have to give up your mobility in order to engage your problems, in order to engage the issues, in order to engage the challenges, head on. That is the mitzvah dorei doros, ultimately again of Gid Hanosha. The Ribbono Shel Olam, it's interesting, didn't trust Yaakov enough to stay put on his own. He might have thought Yaakov Avinu would have taken flight even after the encounter with the Malach. There was still perhaps some time to run. Therefore, the Rebbe Shalom injures him so that he's immobile. And the eternal lesson for us is the need sometimes to immobilize ourselves as well. Shalom is important. Peace is of incredible importance. Shalom is one of our core values, right? Shalom is one of the primary identities. Shalom, MS, are one of the primary identities of the Ribono Shel Olam. There's a time for shalom, but there's also sometimes a time to engage and to figure out how to fix my problems and not to go ahead and constantly run. So if we bring this full circle, again, so we now see David HaMelech kind of gives us a little bit of an allusion to this idea, this dynamic of the brothers who can't get along. And amazing enough that we learn this kapitel on the week, right? On the week of Parshas Vayishlach, the brothers do come together. And here's the amazing part. What's the amazing postscript to the story? The amazing postscript to the story is that sometimes we're so scared to engage our problems. Why? Why? Because we have in our minds an imagined, almost like exacerbated, amplified, exaggerated, like terrible scenario outcome. And what's amazing sometimes, what happens in life, when you find the courage to engage, you realize that sometimes resolution is quite possible. Remember again, brothers see each other. And what happens? What happens? Leaving aside the midrashic interpretations, what happens? What happens? They hug each other. They kiss each other. Right? Esav has gone on to his life and established his identity. Yaakov has gone on to his life and established his identity. Esav is happy with who he is. Yaakov is happy with who he is. And guess what? The brothers are able to bury the hatchet. The brothers are able to let the past be the past. The brothers don't have to dwell on the pain, on the letdown, on the difficulties. Rather, the brothers are just simply able to move on in life, each with their own identity. The incredible Musar, that sometimes when you find the courage to engage the difficult dynamics in life, we become pleasantly surprised with the magnificent outcomes. All right, we'll stop over here. We'll pick up Emirat Hashem with Kapitel Nun next week as well. No class tonight. No class tonight. Sure, have your time.